hello and welcome to Talking Sense, the Sensibility Podcast. I'm your co-host, Erin.
And I'm your co-host, Kat. And today we have a guest co-host, Stephen Payton.
Hello. Yes. my name's Stephen Payton. I'm a journalist slash columnist and terribly online as a human being. and I tend to kind of focus on covering issues around like LGBT rights, environmentalism, and Scottish independence.
Great.
Welcome to our Pride episode.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. So, hell of a Pride month this so far, huh?
Yes, it has been a month. Yes.
And we're recording this right at mid-month. Just about.
Yep. Yes, it is the 16th of June, so we're right in the middle of it. So God knows what's happened between now and when this actually gets released. But so far, we've had unprecedented attacks on Stonewall.
Mm-hmm. Yep, check.
We've had the UK government distancing itself from diversity education. We've had
Hungary.
Yeah, we've had Hungary.
Hungary's just been in the news.
We've had Hungary.
So it's
continuing their trend of rolling back rights on everybody. But this month, of course, they picked the LGBT community.
Well, not everybody. I mean, you'll still have straight white men are going to be great.
Yeah, that's true. But they're like, is it Poland or Hungary that decriminalized like domestic abuse? Like, I think maybe both.
Mm.
Keep women in the house safe and alone. So we can.
Yeah.
And this month we've also had everybody losing their collective minds over NHS staff wearing a rainbow badge to say, hey, it's okay to come talk to me about certain issues.
Yeah, this feels really sinister to me for two reasons. One, because of just like this entire Pride Month being one long sustained attack on the entire community. Mm-hmm. And two, of course, the NHS Rainbow Badge scheme has been around for a while. And when COVID started and the rainbow suddenly became a symbol of the NHS and hope and dealing with this COVID stuff, that sort of diluted the meaning of NHS staff wearing rainbow badges, and now we're just attacking the whole concept of that being a supportive thing for the LGBT community. So
can you take me back a little bit and explain it to the straight lady about, because I know that the badges that they're wearing now are like a pride badge that has it's got the brown, it's the integrated badge,
the progress pride flag.
Thank you. I couldn't remember what it was actually called. And for the COVID stuff, like my kids put stuff in the windows that was like, you know, a half arc rainbow, which was very different from the Pride rainbow flag. Mm-hmm. So did this program roll out beforehand, and was it the Pride flag or?
So this is an older program that's been around for years, and it's sort of, I don't know how official it was, but just that like NHS staff who were like clued up on LGBT issues and were LGBT friendly would wear Pride flag badges, and they were they're the six stripe Pride flag right before this, which mm-hmm. isn't the same as the sort of like rainbow, but is like pretty close. And basically there were a lot of kind of concerns when people started using rainbows as like a COVID hope NHS support symbol, that this was not just diluting that particular scheme, but also just like generally out in public before, when you saw a rainbow on like a shop or whatever, that was specifically a symbol, you know, to indicate support of our community. And then suddenly there were rainbows everywhere, and that sort of diluted the meaning of that somewhat. And then recently they've just changed to the Progress Pride flag on the LGBT NHS rainbow scheme. I don't know if that was planned a long time in advance or not, but the backlash has been unbelievable.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is like like you say, the rainbow flag badges for NHS, like mm-hmm. they existed for quite a long time, and it was understood that if you saw somebody wearing that badge who was like on staff, you knew that as an LGBT person, you could talk about health issues relating to that mm-hmm. that, you know, you might have been slightly worried about, because not necessarily everyone's clued up on it. You know, it's like if you ever go to your doctor and want to talk about mental health stuff, it's a real roll of the dice about the kind of response that you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the rainbow badge was basically to say, hey, I understand this. I'm good to talk to. Come have a chat. Mm-hmm. It's been around for ages. And it's the same weird thing we see with like a lot of weird anti-trans stuff, which is like, people finding out about stuff that has been working just fine for like 15 years and then freaking out about it as if it's a brand new thing that no one's thought of. Like, all these problems around the Gender Recognition Act. It's like, well, we have the Gender Recognition Act already. Trans people have been using bathrooms already. A lot of the stuff that you're raising is not things that are going to happen. It's things that have been happening for decades without issue. And seeing people now like lose their minds over these new badges coming in when an earlier version of it already existed, it just feels very on brand for the entire anti-trans backlash so far.
I think that's a perfect way to put it. It's just completely on brand.
Yeah.
Disappointing, but not surprising.
God.
I can't help but think of how important that is, too, to have those badges. You know, this is something that seems like it's so important, especially for, like, teenagers. And
I mean, like, I'm bi and, like, I'm married to a straight man. So I, like, God, I hate the term passing for privilege. But, like, it's actually kind of the opposite of that, where, like, I'm assumed straight all the time. I don't feel comfortable with, like, the level of biphobia that exists basically everywhere, like, ever talking to my doctor about anything where that might come up. And so, like, to me, having that as a visible symbol of, like, oh, this is someone who it could be safe to talk to about anything related to that, is really, really important. And the idea that there's this massive backlash against it and it's treating people differently and whatever, it's just very, very, very upsetting.
Yeah. For me, it's not even like just necessarily a safety issue, although that's obviously part of it. It's like doctors and nurses need to know an impossible amount of information, you know, like across the board. Like there's so many different illnesses, symptoms, you know, like... No one can retain all that. And so, you know, it's perfectly understandable that if you approach a doctor or a nurse and you're like, hey, this is a health issue that is affecting me as a trans person that a cisgender person would not necessarily be experiencing because of the, like, you know, if you're on hormones or whatever else, it's just good to know that if you see someone wearing that badge, they're probably going to understand what you are talking about in a way that some other people just might not, because it just might not be in their radar. Yeah. And that's fine, but it's at least nice to know this person will probably have an understanding of where they can at least point me without it becoming like a bigger thing, you know? Like, so yeah, it's safeguarding, but it's also just knowledge and understanding.
That makes a lot of sense. Like, I breastfed my kids. You have no idea how many doctors say the wrong things, especially with your first kid. Like, you're always like, I'm going to ruin my child's life or starve them or whatever. By the time I had my second kid, I'd listen to some doctors go, please don't tell anybody that. And, you know, if you usually kind of know if somebody has knowledge in that or not, because they make it very, very visible. So it doesn't mean if somebody is not wearing the badge, it doesn't mean that they're hostile. It just means that that's not their area of expertise.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, that was definitely, I know, one of the reasons that it was brought in the first place. It wasn't just safety. It was, I will actually have a degree of understanding of what you're talking about.
Why would anybody get mad at that?
Ah, well, it's interesting you should say that. it's so weird. It's not weird, actually. It's very predictable. But one of the most frustrating things, like, as a trans person who's been watching a lot of this debate around our lives, is how much we see our concerns around how the debate is being conducted. Like, when we've raised concerns about, like, look, you're talking about rolling back legislation that's already there, you're talking about, you know, bringing in sometimes quite right-wing talking points but sort of repurposed and redressed to be more liberal sounding, because that's unfortunately something that is happening as well. Like, we raise these concerns, like, people say, like, no, we're not talking about rolling back rights, so we're not talking about doing this, we're only concerned about self-ID because we've heard, you know, there's legitimate concerns, right? And then, like, 2 days later, you get this backlash to the NHS using rainbow flags. You're like, see, you keep telling me it's about this one very specific thing, but all of your behavior says otherwise. You know, and it's really frustrating to see, like, when we raise these concerns, them sort of being dismissed by, well, it's just people with legitimate concerns. It's like, no, if you saw everything that they were saying, you would not hold that opinion.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, right? They've been, so there's the, when we were talking about Hungary earlier for a second, and one of the things that, like, one of the terms people use when they're talking about how, like, Orban's been able to just, like, crush the opposition is talk about, like, salami slicing the opposition, finding like teeny teeny little slivers of issues that, like, one part of the opposition can't agree with another part of the opposition can't agree with another part of the opposition, and just, like, thinly slicing it apart. And that's, like, sort of what we're seeing here when they pick these, like, these wedge issues, where they find, like, one tiny tiny little thing that could sound reasonable to one demographic, and then just, like, use that to push more and more extreme talking points.
Yeah. Something that really, really gets to me is how many people are very keen on what seems like outing people, going, we need to absolutely know. And it's like, well, but isn't that the same as outing somebody? Again, I can only relate this as to, like, when I was pregnant and somebody told people at work before I was ready, it was devastating. But then again, that is nowhere near the same thing, you know? And I just, anything that's going to out somebody, I'm just kind of, like, violently opposed to it, just from that, like, small glimpse into what that felt like.
Yeah, it feels a bit like the whole thing of, like, people's trans status must be disclosed is kind of coming from a place that views the fact that a person is trans means that in some way they are a threat or a danger, and then therefore that must be the reason that people know that they are a transgender person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, if we're talking about, like, dating, which is where this often will end up suddenly sliding to, is if there's some sort of, like, secret coercive element to it, is, like, broadly speaking, transgender people, like, regardless of where they are on, or if they are ever going to pursue surgery, are pretty open about who they are. Like, you know, if you're going to get on a date with someone, you generally have conversations, particularly ahead of sex, to kind of, like, discuss where your boundaries are or whatever else. And it's like to act as if, like, all these trans people are, like, trying to sneak under the radar is absolutely wild. It doesn't make any sense unless you're coming from it with this sort of mindset of trans people are a threat and that is the way they must be treated, which is kind of coming back to other conversations we can have about how gay people were viewed in the 80s and 90s, you know?
Well, it's all the exact same language, isn't it? About, like, they don't belong in sports teams, they don't belong in bathrooms, they don't belong in changing rooms, threat to children, and, like, it's the exact same language. Like, I mean, we've got the, you know, anti-trans sort of people in Scotland now trying to claim that the Scottish government is in cahoots with all of the LGBT charities to, like, reduce the age of consent to 10, which is completely ludicrous. And, like, it was, like,
QAnon.
Extremely.
Yeah, it was QAnon level connecting unrelated pieces of information, because the ILGA said that, like, we need to, like, decriminalize adolescents, like, expressions of sexuality. And what they clearly mean, stop criminalizing 16-year-olds for having relationships with each other. Mm. Stop, like, having unequal ages of consent between LGBT people and straight people. And, like, don't basically criminalize teenagers for having a sexuality. And then one of the conspirators went and said, aha, but this other organization says the definition of adolescent is over the age of 10.
Yep.
Therefore, they want to decriminalize. It's just, no, this isn't how any of this works. This isn't how words work.
See, what you've done there, Erin, is this little thing of taking a quote and then putting it into the context in which it was written.
Yes.
And a lot of people aren't interested in doing that when it doesn't benefit them. Like, watching the fallout for that was absolutely wild because, well, first of all, I mean, it was such an intentionally bad faith reading of, yes, what had actually been written. And then the fact it took the definition of adolescent from an entirely disconnected organization,
yes,
that had not necessarily factored into, like, when that was written. And then, I think most importantly, was the fact that they said, this is what Stonewall is proposing, because Stonewall is a part of this organization.
Yes.
And it's like, cool, so are about 150 other organizations.
Yeah.
And the fact you've singled right in on the LGBT rights one, I went, aha, yeah, pedos, says a lot about what you were looking for, what you were looking to find, and not what is actually there. That was what was most revealing about that to me.
It's so sinister. How many of these things, like, I see a lot of them as an obsession with stranger danger and whipping up the, you don't know what's out there. And it's like, you know who usually is the perpetrators of these kind of assaults?
It's your family most of the time.
It's not a stranger. It's not somebody who's tricking you. It's a family member. It's a friend. Like, that is what we need to be scared about. That's what we need to be nervous about. Like, a false sense of security does no one any favors. And it's just makes me so mad.
Especially because, like, you know, a lot of the people who are arguing or making this case against transgender people or whatever else, it's like, they are, you know, in other aspects of their politics, like, pretty feminist. It's like, they know this. Mm-hmm. Like, they know those stats. They know that is where, you know, assault tends to come from, not from strangers, but from people close to you. It just gets kind of thrown out the window when it's not relevant to the argument about people using bathrooms with transgender people, or how men are apparently going to pretend to be trans to come into bathrooms. It's like, they don't need to do that.
Yeah.
No, they don't.
They're already assaulting people.
No, exactly.
Whoever thought a public toilet was a safe space? I mean, come on. And they're scary. That's where all the slasher flicks have, like, people getting murdered. They didn't have a gender self-ID.
Oh my god. Sorry, that, like, horrible scene in Scream. Okay, yes. And of course, like, this extends to, like, you know, just coming into Pride Month at the end of May, you know, like, on the UK level, the EHRC left the Stonewall's, like, diversity champion program. Like, the EHRC, like, I'm incoherent with, like, rage right now. And, I mean, the reason I've been paying attention at the UK level as much as the Scottish level is that, I'm one of the founders of the End Conversion Therapy Scotland campaign group. And one of the frustrations that we've had is that there's been a response of, the government, the Westminster government has pledged to bring in a ban on conversion therapy. And, you know, in order to have the most efficient use of legislative time, if they're producing a ban, we want to just sort of, like, replicate their ban. And if they don't move to bring a ban, we will. But the chances of us getting an actual conversion therapy ban that is inclusive of trans people and doesn't have a dozen loopholes is not good. And I'm really concerned that we're here in Scotland going to keep kicking a can down the road on that to see what Westminster does. And I don't really feel comfortable as well with their definition of, well, if Westminster brings a ban, then we will just move on that. They haven't given us any assurances on what they will consider an adequate ban from Westminster. So, yeah, we've got kind of two levels to worry about.
Yeah. They kicked the can for GRA, and look, did that do any bad? Oh, only a lot. Like, whole fucking mess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the exact same concerns when the SNP published their manifesto. It was just one of those things of just like, but why wait? Why bother waiting, like, when you could do it and you'll probably, you know, if you come at it with the right approach, have a stronger response than what you're going to get from the Tories. I mean, the Tories are shoring up this, like, little culture war that they're sort of propagating at the moment to build up their own base. Like, they aren't interested in really putting forward an actual robust ban. They're just going to play to their audience as they have been and as they're going to continue to do so, particularly using the fact that transgender people are a wedge issue. It'd be so wild for me if, like, after everything that they've been kind of, like, moving forward with, like, kicking GRA, you know, into space and meeting with these organizations, if they then turned around and was like, all right, but here's actually a robust bill on stopping people from basically being forced to pretend that they are cisgender. It's like, that would blow my mind if they could somehow pull that out. But it's not going to happen.
No, it's not going, like, to happen.
Either way, we're not going to get a robust bill from Westminster, and there's no point in waiting for it.
No, there certainly is no point in waiting for it, because all of the relevant powers are devolved anyway. The only powers that aren't devolved are professional regulation, and that is, like, frankly, the least part of it.
Yeah.
Most of conversion therapy that happens is in informal environments. So we have the power in Scotland to ban, like, criminally ban, provision of forcing someone to undergo advertising or removing someone from Scotland to undergo conversion therapy. So we should just do it.
Yeah.
So is there any chance that they can like bundle this with the GRA and like get it through?
Let's just cram two pieces of really controversial legislation together and hope for the best.
Let's get it over with. Like, we need to do this and some people are going to be mad. Where is it? Like, I'm tapping my watch right now. Like, where's our GRA bill?
Not anytime soon.
I know. So like, Stephen, you're not a party member. So that's, this is great.
I am not.
Well, I want to hear an outside perspective of like, what'll surprise you.
I mean, I don't know how soon it could come. Like, I understood the argument when it got kicked down the road that the pandemic had to take priority, right? That's an entirely reasonable position. It's just that given the time when it was kicked down the road, and I'm pretty sure there was a comment from one MSP talking about kicking it into the long grass, which means something very different. Like, given the absolute failure of the SNP to actually tackle transphobia within the party, and given the fact that they had already repeatedly delayed GRA reform, despite the fact that you got a consultation coming back saying the majority of people supported it, despite the fact that feminist organizations came out and said we support it, despite polling saying what's up, most women support this, like, and then to sort of kick it down the line again, it's just like, I couldn't honestly even begin to sort of say when I think it will make a reappearance. You know, other than that, I mean, I guess it's the potential that if there is going to be some sort of cooperation agreement between the SNP and the Scottish Greens, the Greens might be like, this needs to be a degree of a priority.
Good God, I hope so.
I could potentially bring it back around again, but it's hard to say when it would happen. And it would be nice for it to happen, particularly because, you know, I know Nicola Sturgeon's kind of voiced that she wants to fix the damage that's been done. I don't think the party's unfortunately done anything to actually fix that yet, or, you know, made any steps to do that, at least not publicly, other than saying they would. So yeah, it's very frustrating to be a transgender person in Scotland at the moment and knowing that the kind of governing party isn't actually moving forward with any of the legislation that it was elected on and has now been re-elected on in terms of manifesto promises to bring the GRA up to date, and importantly as well, to properly invest in like transgender healthcare, you know, which is a huge issue as well that gets less attention, but it really shouldn't, because it's probably more concerning and more urgent than GRA reform.
Yes, I would, yeah, I agree that it's like urgent that gender identity clinic wait times are brought in line with every other NHS wait time. Mm-hmm.
That was probably the thing in the manifesto that made me go, you know, this is giving me a little hope that they pledged to put some more money to that, because it's harder to argue with that. Hey, it's more healthcare. That's what you wanted, right? Yeah. But yeah, we've had some talks about women's health now. Yesterday, I think we've had pandemic recovery help, and you know, like, where is it? I'm not hearing enough about it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Given we're talking about health funding, let's, yeah, cause we had cancer robots today and endometriosis today. So
cool.
Come on, guys.
I feel extremely guilty sometimes. My husband quit the party over the transphobia. Then he realized, you know, we're from America, so we're like Democrats on the far left of that party, and we kind of, it's just feel like you're banging your head against a wall all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean I don't necessarily have an answer of exactly what people can do to be better, other than just like continue to remain vocal, you know. Like, obviously there's arguments for like why you should leave the party and arguments for why you should stay in the party, and when a lot of people left the party it did seem to actually prompt action. You know, I can also understand the perspective of wanting to stay in to like facilitate change, like Out for Independence have been doing. Mm-hmm. It's there's not necessarily a clear answer, I don't think. It's just about remaining vocal and supportive and understanding of where people are coming from, and what, and you know, like really trying to like facilitate change as well, like within the party from your own actions and pushing for that legislation to kind of be relevant still, you know, because yeah, I know the SNP likes to listen to its members every now and then, so you know.
Oh, gosh. Sorry, I shouldn't have laughed so hard at the idea that the SNP likes to listen to its members.
I mean, I'd say every now and then, so.
Yes.
I think a lot of times, like, when actually the whole, like, public, or at least the whole membership, not the people just shouting on social media, vote on things, it's actually more progressive than you would think. Like, I usually am like, oh, okay, maybe I could keep going, because when all the screaming stops and there's an actual vote, it seems to usually go the right direction, or the left direction. But
yeah, like when the hate crimes bill was happening, right? Like, a lot of us watched that with like deep concern over how that was going to go, and then it was not even close. So yeah, it sometimes when the screaming stops, mm-hmm. the voting actually turns out a lot better than you expect it to. Though, gosh, the entire process of that hate crimes bill was
ugly,
mm-hmm. very ugly,
and very similar to GRE.
I mean, that's when we had one of our waves of resignations, actually, was over the amendments to the hate crimes bill.
What were you saying, Stephen?
I was just saying it's very similar to the GRA, in that, like, what people were saying it stood for didn't really necessarily align with what it actually stood for.
Maybe we should do a little 101 level explanation for our listeners what this legislation actually does. Okay, so...
God, yeah.
Let's define self-ID for the people who are listening.
Yeah, and here's what it does and does not actually do.
Yeah.
You know, like in terms of access to bathrooms or anything like that, no one's asking for a birth certificate when you're going into a bathroom. So therefore, self-ID has nothing to do with that and never has.
Yes.
And actually, the people that would want a job checking genitals at a bathroom door, on a toilet door, are probably not the people you want to do that. Like, who would have that job?
You just made me slightly ill, Kat.
No, they're just fine, upstanding citizens who definitely want to check what's in a kid's trousers, and they can be trusted far more than a transgender person just trying to take a piss. Yes. Don't you know?
Exactly. When you actually sit and think about it, it's like, oh wait, this is insane. Yeah.
Yeah. But for our listeners, all self-ID means is that to change your birth certificate, you don't need to go through years of dealing with the medical establishment. It means, is it a notarized thing, or an oath or an affidavit or something, and then you go and get your birth certificate changed. That's it. Instead, that's all they mean by self-ID. That's it. It just makes it slightly easier to get your birth certificate changed.
That's it. I mean, other pieces of other pieces of information, like people's passports and driving licenses, are far easier to change, and oftentimes are already updated to be like the right gender marker. It's just birth certificates that have been the slightly more difficult one, and the question always being, when was the last time you ever really had to use a birth certificate? You know, it's pretty much just that's what was so weird about the GRA reform, the anger around it is like, and I think one of the reasons maybe people come into it slightly naively is that, like, on paper, this is nothing. Yeah. This is like such a minor piece of legislation to just like, oh, we'll just bring that in line with everything else that is already in place. I don't think anyone was ready for like it becoming this flashpoint for something bigger.
No.
Like, because like, again, when you really dig into what self-ID is, what GRE reform is, it is like a piddly little bit of legislation, which is one of the reasons I'm really annoyed about, like, when I see ALBA trying to mask their whole anti-trans thing. It was like, no, people should have a right to make a decision, so we should have a citizens assembly about it. It's like, well, that's like having a citizens assembly to decide what you're going to have for dinner. It's so much effort for something almost inconsequential in the scheme of things, you know. It's the amount of backlash to it is bonkers. Anyway.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I've got two things to say about that. One, yes, they want a citizens assembly on something that is fundamentally just like so tiny, like ways to make it easier to change your birth certificate, which,
yeah,
duh. But like, the other thing is they want a citizens assembly, which, if chosen at random, is almost certainly going to be 99% cis people, mm-hmm. To decide on the rights of a small and vulnerable minority.
Yeah,
that's not how minority rights in a liberal democracy work. You do not have the majority decide on the rights of the minority.
Yeah,
because liberal democracy means more than just the majority rules. It means guaranteed rights, and it means protection of the rights of people who don't compose the majority. It it just blows my mind that we have lost the basic conception of what the other things that go along with democracy are.
Something that like really always drives it home for me is how deeply anti-immigrant it is for it to be your birth certificate and for, you know, passports and driver's licenses, ID you carry on you are already different, but it's about a birth certificate that you have to be born here for it to apply to you. Because what happened with Riddle's job, she doesn't have self-ID. Of course she doesn't. She wasn't born here. It doesn't matter if you have self-ID here or not, because it wouldn't change her non-British birth certificate. Like,
Right. So when, like, what you mean is when they say like, oh, you should have to have a GRA to do XYZ thing. It's like, or like a gender recognition, sorry, GRC, gender recognition certificate. You should have to have that to be able to do XYZ thing. But you can only get that if you're trying to change your birth certificate, which you can only do if you were born here.
Yeah, you're already saying like, okay, all these immigrants, they can't get one, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. According to this like policy. So that's just another way they can like other minimize people that aren't born. You know, you're not supposed to have to be born in Scotland to be Scottish, right?
Yeah. We're both immigrants, so we both get very angry about immigrant issues.
No, but it's just one of the, like another way where it's like this discussion has just fundamentally overlooked people's circumstances and where they're coming at it from, and it's viewing it in a very small-minded way, the discussion about what it is to be a trans person. Like, you know, it's when we're talking about like legal documents, that's not what makes somebody a transgender person. They already are that person. They already are the gender that they align with. Mm-hmm. It's literally just about bringing documentation in to make their life slightly easier and living within a society that requires that we have all these documents.
Yeah.
You know, it's the documents don't make the person, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same way that you're still gay, even if you haven't got gay marriage yet, you know, like it's still, but that was like a thing. It's like if the legislation didn't exist, well, you know, before gay marriage was legal, cool, people were still having the equivalent of what a long-term, or not the equivalent, we're having like a long-term loving relationship, like same-sex relationships that were basically the exact same as what you would call marriage, mm-hmm. just not recognized legally in the eyes of the state. You know, it's just the state sometimes takes a little bit longer to catch up, which is unfortunate.
Yeah,
we all just need a little bit better education. Like, I hate how much crap the Thai campaign gets, because like my son was in P1 when they started, when that got implemented, and like it's just really great. It's great as he learns stuff, like he's 9 now, and like the vocabulary that kids have, like that gives me hope for the future a little bit even when it gets me down, because it's like, oh my gosh, you get it. Like kids just automatically get it, the things they can understand, and just never ceases to amaze me.
That's why growing up here, like a lot of the time when I was at high school, it was after Section 28 had been repealed, or Section 2A in Scotland, and you know that wasn't in place anymore, but it was kind of like, okay, cool, we've taken away the ban on discussing these issues, but we haven't actually brought anything into the education system around it, so it still kind of existed functionally for quite a while after that. You know, even if you couldn't go to jail for mentioning it anymore. But it just means that, like, so many of us grew up without ever having access to that education, you know, and not being able to find things out about ourselves until much later. And it's one of the reasons I think, you know, you're talking about, like, kids now coming home and having this, like, better understanding of, like, you know, your social relationships and the people around them is great, and it's good for everyone. In fact, actually, I'm sure I saw a study today showing that like the sort of like health and well-being of LGBT kids was improved in schools with inclusive education, but also the psychological well-being of straight children as well. Like everyone benefited because everyone had a better understanding of, I guess, the world around them as a result. It was a good thing for everyone. And yeah.
Yeah, I think it totally makes sense that it also improved things for the straight kids, because like every kind of oppression is linked together, right? Like transphobia is related to homophobia, is related to misogyny. Like they're all related. And if you're improving kids' understanding of LGBT issues, you're also probably improving their sort of ability to see like gender expression and gender presentation, even of like cis people or straight people, in a more like wide scope. So probably far less like bullying artsy, even like cishet boys, and like probably less bullying straight sporty girls and that sort of thing as well. Like, I think it's probably just better for everyone.
Yeah, anything that undermines the patriarchy is good for everyone involved.
Yes.
Traditional gender roles can get to fuck. Like, I hate them. I hate them. They ruin everything for everyone, no matter who you are, no matter what, you know, who you love, they ruin everything.
Yeah, they just get in the way entirely.
That's good. Well, do you want to tell us anything else about yourself? Like, I know you introduced yourself and what you do or anything, but like, I don't know, you're the first person that's like Scottish, born in Scotland, I think.
Oh yeah, you're the first Scottish person on the show.
Interesting.
The first non-new Scot.
Huh. I mean, that's cool. It's nice to have a New Scots podcast, which recognizes what it actually is to be a new Scot. That's a lovely thing.